You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, the Belly Dance Geek, and welcome to episode 62 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, things like moves, combos, choreographies, there are a lot of resources out there. But if you want help with the why and the how, so things like musicality, culture, business, ethics, composition, all of those things can be a little bit harder to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for questions and answers so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Sahra Kent, also known as Sahra Saida. She started her belly dance career in the Arabic nightclub, The Cascades, in Los Angeles. And while she'd always been interested in the intersection of culture and dance, she did a bachelor's degree in cultural anthropology and archaeology, a need to grow as a dancer sent her to the University of California in Los Angeles, where she pursued a master's degree in dance ethnology. Through the course of her study, she had the amazing good fortune to find a great friend and mentor in her program, Farida Fahmy. And when the time came to begin research for her thesis on the Zafat al-Arusa, Farida encouraged her to come to Cairo and pursue that research in person. While in Egypt, she received a contract with the Meridian Heliopolis five-star hotel, which she held for nearly 6 years. Her position as a local dancer gave her an amazing springboard to learn about the Zafa and so much more. Sahra now teaches and dances around the world, sharing her theories on dance in Egypt, the regions, what she calls the tables, and the way everything fits together. She's constantly conducting more research with 2 trips to Egypt each year, each time hunting for that next puzzle piece that will reveal ever more about the dance and the culture that she fell in love with over 30 years ago. You can find more information at her website, journeythroughegypt.com. Or if you want to hear more about that tables concept, you can check out her previous appearance on the Clubhouse. That was episode number 23, The Puzzle of Egyptian Folklore. So welcome back, Sahra.
It's so good to be back. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
I am so happy to have you back, especially since having taken Journey Through Egypt 1, which I highly, highly recommend.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right. So today we are talking about something that we actually touched on a little bit in JTE 1, which were Egyptian molids. And I'm pretty sure I'm not pronouncing that properly. So would you say that for me?
A mulid.
Mulid. Thank you.
Mulid, yeah.
Excellent. Yes. But before we jump into that, I always ask my guests about their origin stories. And it sounds like we covered some of that in your bio, but is there anything that you'd like to tell us about how you got started in Oriental dance or how you got interested in this particular topic?
Let me think. I think it's important to mention that I found Oriental dance when I had given up pursuing dance as a profession. And I'm glad that I did because I had a chance to get into cultural anthropology and, you know, do my, you know, university. But also it came from, I found that I really needed to dance for myself. So I thought that was really, really important. And I know other dancers who have, you know, they feel like giving it up and things like that, or should I or shouldn't I? Once you give it up, and you find out you can't, it changes something. You never have to ask that question again, and you start finding yourself like an authentic place where you need to dance, where it's an important subject inside of yourself. So that I feel is important to people, and also not doing it just as a profession, but really knowing that you need dance in your life. So that was important. And, well, right now what I'm doing is, as you mentioned, the research work, the tours also are doing great. And I love to share all this information. But now we've, in one of the tours every year, the main one, we go to a mulid while we're there. So that's exciting. But also I'm doing a lot of work right now, on the archive, so that I can get the video out there that I've been so interested in for, oh, we won't even say how many decades at this point. But anyway, so that's what's going on right now.
All right, great. Well, let's start at the very beginning. So what is a Mulud?
Okay. Mulud is a Saints Day celebration. It's Sufi-based, or at least it's put on by a Sufi group, sometimes more than one of them in any particular city. There's a lot of them in Egypt. Egypt happens to have a lot of Sufi groups there, although they kind of keep it on the down low. But there's a lot of different Sufi groups in Egypt, throughout Egypt, plenty in the Delta, plenty in Upper Egypt. I'm more familiar with the ones in Upper Egypt now because that's where my research is centering. And especially in the month of Shaban, it's a lunar year. So, you know, every year that month comes forward 2 weeks. It's not a solar year like we have, it's lunar. And the month right after Shaban is Ramadan, which you know is the holy month where they fast. So it's kind of like how you have the fasting month, but the month right before everybody celebrates and, you know, they have their mulud, there's a lot of weddings, you know, so you know how that works. So right before we have a holy time, then we usually have a time that we celebrate right before.
So, kind of like
anyway,
Mardi Gras.
Exactly. So that month, there's a lot of muluds, although there are other muluds in different parts of the year. And some of them are solar, some of them are lunar, some of them are hooked into harvest, you know, different things like that. But it's basically, it has its religious aspects because it's Sufi-based, but also it has a lot of secular aspects, which is just, you know, like celebration and the whole family comes and they come in from the countryside as well. And they have their Sufi movement and music, but then they also have sweets and what are sorts of games for the kids. And it's just a big family time. It's really fun. There's something there for everybody.
All right. Now, maybe this is getting a little bit too far from the topic, but, you know, in the Islamic world, what makes someone a saint? I know, you know, my whole family is Catholic, and so there's a very official process for this. Is that something that's generally universally recognized, or do different people have different opinions about who's a saint and who's not?
To vastly oversimplify, it's different people have different opinions on it. There's different groups, and different groups see different people as the important person. Although, if somebody can be a saint in another religion, like Christianity, if we have a saint, it could easily be recognized also by Islam, because a holy person is a holy person. So it's not so, how can I say it? So, I don't know how to say the word. Different groups will have different opinions on who's the saint. But it's kind of like the people of the local area all kind of agree on it.
Gotcha.
That way, yeah.
And do you know when the tradition of celebrating Mulud started?
I got to get more into the history. I know it's like centuries. It's been centuries. So, but I don't know exactly when. A lot of information about Sufism is kept rather quiet. It's not a part of mainstream Islam, especially the resurgence of Islam right now. Some of them believe in it. Most of them don't. It's not one particular Sufi group. So I was trying to break into this. I was trying to find more about it for, I would say, about 2 decades before I finally was able to attend a mulud and be in the middle of it. It's like once you know about it, then suddenly you can know a lot about it, because then you can start attending other ones. And but again, you show up, and then when people, you know, after a couple of years of showing up, people figure you're real about it, and you're not, you know, trying to embarrass them about something, and then suddenly you can find out all the stuff that's been happening all along.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now you said that it's
kind of complicated.
Not, it's always complicated, right?
That's
why it's on your t-shirts, right?
Exactly.
If it wasn't complicated, it wouldn't make a good interview topic, right?
That's probably true.
All right. Now you talked about Sufi groups putting these on. Is that the equivalent of like what we might consider a church or like a religious community that practices together, or is it something larger and more official?
It's not very official. It's more like a community, although within the community there are rules, and there's also, you know, different sheikhs that are important. Different Sufi groups will have a different rigidity about different ones. Different people will make a pledge to the Sufi group, and it's all between him, the group, and God. How do I say it? This is one of those weird things that Sufism is, there's so many different groups. I don't want to oversimplify, because one group, I'll figure it out, not figure it out, but I'll have more of a feeling about it. And then I go and find out about another one, and they break all the rules of the first one. So that's one of the reasons that mainstream Islam is not really backing it, is because there's so much individuality, and it's not strict, if we can say that.
Gotcha. All right. Yeah. So what kinds of features do mullahs tend to include? You mentioned a little bit of the entertainments. Would you mind going over that in a little more detail?
Sure. Talk about one particular mullah right now, and this one's called the Abu Hagag, and it was a particular man named Abu Hagag. Actually, they named him that, and which means father of pilgrimages. But he was from a different area, but he located himself around Luxor and was there for a long time. A lot of people thought that he was just kind of a wanderer. But then people started saying that there were miracles that happened in his presence. And after he passed away, people started even talking about it more and more and more, about what a special person he had been and miracles and all this. And he became known to be a saint. Okay, so then mullahs started happening around him, and people would come to his area, and different Sufi groups saw him as an important person, not just one. And so these mullahs, maybe, let's say, in a particular family, maybe somebody is a member of a particular Sufi group. Okay, so possibly this might, let's say, be the father. So he's involved with the Sufi group, and he's organizing the mullah. And another important part of the Sufism and the mullah is to make food for the poor. So now other people in the family will be busy making food for the poor. And then they'll all show up at the mullah, and you have to have something there for the children. So you also have children's rides. And most of these rides are the kind of thing that can be pulled in by a truck. So it's rides that fit on the back of a flatbed truck, basically. So you have like small Ferris wheels and kind of things that swing back and forth or turn around in circles, and these kind of, just like a, how can I say, just like a community, I don't know, like a fair kind of thing. So they bring in these things for the kids. There's also always places that have sweets. In the old days, they used to have sugar dolls. Now they have the sweets booths, and they have different kinds of mullah sweets. And they also sell dolls, although I haven't seen more than a couple of sugar dolls the whole time I've been going. This is more nostalgia now. But so they have something for the kids, something for the people who are not into the Sufism but are into helping other people and community, and then the other people who really are into the actual Sufi devotions. So you'll have all these people showing up, and also maybe somebody in the family is part of this, but then the extended family shows up and has picnics, you know. So it's just a happiness kind of thing. You don't have to really be part of that particular Sufi group that puts it on to enjoy the time. Some of the big ones, like this one, Abu Hagag, I show up with plenty of days beforehand just in case somehow I don't get the date right, because it keeps changing. And so about more like 5 or 6 days beforehand, you can hear the Sufi music from across the Nile. And I've gone over there, and there's maybe only like 6, 7, 8 people who are doing the movement, and of course the musicians and the sheikh. And every night the attendance to this thing grows. So just the sound is pulling people in. A lot of times in Egypt, there isn't a strong start to something. It kind of, you know, you hear about it, you get your act together, you pack, you get family together, and then you come. So it's more of a organic, you know, kind of thing. Then there's a definite finish. So the mulud is growing and growing, and more people are coming and doing business, and more people are coming to enjoy it. And then on a particular night is the big night, the Layla Kabira, and that's the big night. So everybody comes that night, and that's when whole families show up, and they have picnics, and they have they go around on the rides, and they're going through the kiosk to buy little things and eating the sweets and all that kind of stuff, and the next day it's finished. So even though there's not a strong beginning, there's a strong ending. So some of the ones, especially the local neighborhood ones, mulids, it might just be one big day, or on the big ones you might have a whole week of it growing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
All right. Now, you mentioned that there are some of the religious devotions. Can you tell us more about what tends to happen there?
Yes, they all get together. There's community as well, and it's not real strict. People are just happy and getting together. And then at some point, the prayers start, and the sheikh is saying prayers, and then the music starts. For the ones that I go to, there's other ones that are more strict and don't allow music, instruments, and it's only like clapping and voice. But I'm going to talk about the ones that do include instruments. So the music starts, and then the movement starts. Some of the movement might be, and this is what we call zikr movement. So some of the movement, if you're doing like a Sufi Mevlevi dervish from Turkey, you'll have them turning. There's a whole ritual of leading to the turning. In Egypt, of course, that came to them during the Ottoman Empire. How, we are not quite sure, but it got turned into the tanur. So there's turning, but Egypt is a little bit more of an entertainment kind of thing rather than devotions. But so the Egyptian devotions are more like there's the chanting. So you can have like chanting the name of God with this, I'm not going to do it, but it's with strong, you know, your breath coming out strongly on each syllable. It's a special sound. And there's movement with it to make the torso, you know, fill with air and then collapse on the exhalation. There's also most of the movement we see is one that they're standing and they drop down to one forward diagonal and come around and then drop down to the other forward diagonal. So it's kind of like a figure eight kind of thing. That one is done a lot. That one I see it every mule I've ever gone to. I would say that's the one I see most in Egypt. But there's a lot of different movement. There's also come straight forward and then straight back. They don't have to all move in the same way, because once you start trancing, the movement kind of takes over its own way. But people who observe the different groups tend to go to quite a few of these devotions. And so even while they're trancing, they tend to do the same movement in a similar way if you're used to being with one group. So there's a lot of different kinds of movement, but basically what it's doing is making you trance out, because the whole objective is to have your devotions personally between you and God. So it's like a direct experience of God.
Excellent. Now, you know, from mulet to mulet, are there certain things that tend to be present in more of them than not, or some things that tend to vary a lot from one to the other?
It seems like they have their own personalities. Different mulets, like one will be, because there's a lot of other things that go on with the mulet. Like, let's say Abu Hagag again, one of the things it's famous for is like about a 3-day tatib tournament. And this doesn't have anything to do with Sufism, but it's nearby, it's in the same area. But guys come out of the countryside and, you know, tatib is the martial arts stick fight contest. And so that goes on for about 3 days. And that's really fun to watch. But not every mulet has that. It just happens to be in several different mulets that are very famous for it. Then also they have the mirmah. And the mirmah is the running of the horses. Horses are something very special for Saidi people. And it has a long history, although I'm trying to figure it all out. It's hard to research, but a lot of the people, so I'm not sure whether it's like a romantic history or if it really is a history, but they say that in the old days there used to be jousting, although the way they say that word so easily, I'm not sure if it really means what we think it means, or they've been, you know, told that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to have much jousting kind of look to it when I see it, but it's basically is that they kind of hang around, and then the horse runs really, really, really fast across the field, and then they kind of hang out, and another horse runs really, really fast. So they just say that it's really fun. I don't see any particular game involved, but it's, they do enjoy it, and so quite a few of them are famous for those. I know horses are something very special for, and to be able to afford a horse is something special too, because they don't use them for farming. They use other farms, I mean, other animals for farming. So it's something very special to own a horse. So these are two of the things that certain mulets are famous for. Other ones, one that I really want to see that that's up in the Delta, and I have to figure out exactly when and where and all that kind of it is, but they're especially known for their these amazing decorated camels. They're decorated like the old days, back when Egypt had more money than Saudi Arabia, and so Egypt paid for the covering of the Kaaba, and very elaborate with handwork and embroidery and all this. And it was carried from Cairo across to Sinai and down to Mecca by these particular camels in a large procession. And it was especially fortuitous, I guess, if you could accompany that on your pilgrimage. But they have these camels with these big kettle drums and the whole procession. And someday I really want to see that. That's up in the Delta. So there's a lot of, each mulet has its own personality, and there's a lot of history involved. So that's one of the reasons that it really speaks to me, is you can see these things that you don't see in today's Egypt, but they have, you know, the history of centuries. And so something is like, why did they do that? And then you start getting into this really rich information about the history of the area.
And so it sounds like a lot of the differences from one to the other are largely about local preferences. Do you know if there are any differences due to, you know, facts about the saint that they're celebrating that you're aware of?
This is what was strange, is when I started trying to figure this out, I was relating the differences between the Mulids to the saints that they were that they were remembering, is the right word there. Mm-hmm. And I was really trying to figure that out, and I kept hitting dead ends, and it seems more like the personality of the area and what the people have continued, you know. So the particular saint, of course, is very important, and when you ask about him, then you'll hear about the miracles that he performed and how, you know, different people, maybe they needed something really badly or somebody's health was involved, and then the saint walked by, or somebody thought it was just a homeless wanderer and gave them some money or something like that, just being nice to a homeless person, and then suddenly their health was better. You know, so it's those kind of stories, but that story doesn't show up in the Mulid. Again, Abu Hagag is something special in that it has the Dora. The Dora is, you know, they have the Leila Kabira, which is the big night, and everybody shows up and has a big community get-together. The next day, they have a Dora, which is a parade through the streets. And it's a crazy, noisy, wonderful parade, and I really enjoy it. But the Dora isn't normally part of a Mulid. This is something special for that area that goes clear back to pharaonic times. So I am sensing that the personality of the Mulid is more about the people of the area rather than the particular saint. However, if I get into the ones in Cairo, it might have more to do with the particular saint. But when I was living in Cairo, I was showing up to the Mulid, and it was just so absolutely overwhelming to have all these different Sufi groups and different back streets and the different ways they would move and sound. And of course, I didn't want to push my way in and start asking questions. I was still on an observational kind of, still affecting me rather than trying to understand it. But when I talk to people, they pretend like they don't know anything about Sufism. And then I find out later that, you know, they know all about it and it's been part of their life for a long time. So that was a hard part, is trying to find information about it. Although people will talk about the miracles that a particular saint would do, that doesn't seem to be a problem. It's just if I start asking about Sufi groups, then that's kind of quiet. It's an interesting research project. It really is.
All right. Well, you know, that's a good segue into my next question. So I was going to ask you about, you know, what these mean to everyday Egyptians. And it sounds like we've covered a lot of that. But could we dig a mm-hmm. little bit deeper into, you know, how Sufism is seen and different levels of approval or disapproval? And how that affects how people see Mulids and whether everybody goes or some people go?
A lot of people go that are not connected, that are not a member of a Sufi group. There's kind of like some people who are fine about Sufism and they show up to the Mulids and they feel very, very good about Sufism, but they personally haven't made their oath yet. The oath can be really difficult to follow. And once you've given your oath and you have joined a membership or joined a Sufi group, and you have to do certain things, like do a particular prayer a certain number of times a day, and you have to show up for certain events, and it's difficult, and it well not difficult it takes a lot of time and energy and often money. So a lot of people have not made their oath, although they feel fine about Sufism. There's other people, especially with the new mainstream Islam coming through, that they don't feel good about Sufism at all. And there's been several times that different groups tried to make Egypt stop doing the mulids. And at one particular time, several years ago, they did cancel one of the biggest mulids. I don't want to get into the politics or anything, but it's not canceled anymore. So, but they kind of keep on the down low. Now I've gotten off the subject. I'm trying to remember what you just asked.
That was where we were going, was the
okay,
differences
good,
of opinion
good.
About Sufism and how that
okay.
affects.
Yeah. So,
right.
And why different people go, you also asked?
Yeah.
A lot of people just come for the party and just enjoy it. There's plenty of people that, like I said, they enjoy Sufism, but they're not, they haven't taken their oath, their personal oath to it, but they can still go in and do the movement and feel altered or trance out. So there's a lot of people coming and, enjoying it and feeling that special feeling, and also the community and the happiness and all that, although they're not a strict member yet.
Great. So, getting a little bit into more, practical details about how we might engage
mm-hmm.
with this. So first off, how do
mm-hmm.
you find out about these?
Took me forever. Well, it was pretty easy to, because I was living in Cairo, and it was pretty easy to find out about the big mulets like Hussein and Prophet Muhammad and, different mulets in Cairo, because, I had my band and I knew people, and people would start talking about, oh, no, you can't go down that street next week because there's going to be the mulid. And I'm just like, where and how, all that kind of stuff. So as far as I know, I didn't know any Sufi people, but they all knew when the mulids were going to be. It's very possible that I knew people that were, privately Sufi, but, didn't talk about it unless somebody really knows about it. So I was going to those. Those were pretty easy to find out. But then I kept hearing about this great Abu Hagag Mulid in Luxor, and that it had the Tatib, and that it had the Mirmah, and that, how wonderful it was. And was no problem for me to go, because some of it I got that might be too private, and other ones are very welcoming to everybody. So I kept hearing about this. So for, of course, while I was working in Cairo, there was no way to get down to Luxor. So I had to wait until I moved back here and then came back to Egypt. And according to some tour books, you look them up and they're, Abu Hagag Mulid happens in, let's just say, October or something. And I'm just like, okay, so I start planning. And I talked to people and going, no, it's not in October. Okay. So every book that I read that's supposed to tell me, and website that I would go to of tour companies, all of the information was not right. And so finally, I just started going to Luxor and trying to find out, from the people. You would think that if you just ask, it's one of the biggest things that happen. And then I finally was told that, it was last month. So I noted the date. Okay, so I showed up the next year at that time. And they're going, oh, no, it just happened, just like, ah. So anyway, and then so that happened several years. And because it's not easy to be so flexible when you have to fly in, you can't wait until you hear the Sufi music and then decide to, pack and, take your water buffalo over. So anyway, So finally, I found, because I wasn't going to take a group until I knew for sure I could get there at the right time. So finally, I started finding out that it was on the lunar year, not the solar year. So that made more sense. And I did go 4 years in a row to make sure that I would be able to get there at the right time. And so once I started going every year, then, you know, I still don't, well, they don't know for sure within like 2 or 3 days. It's like nobody knows for sure when Ramadan starts. You can look it up, and some act as though they know exactly for sure, but like this year, it was supposed to be on one date, and then they decided it was the day after, because it all has to do with the moon and all someone going and observing the moon and all this kind of stuff. So it is really difficult to find out if you're not from the area. And even if you know somebody from the area, the dates that they tell you might be off by a week. So to put it part of a tour was kind of difficult. And even then, I make sure we get in like 2 days ahead of time, and we have a couple extra days at the end of Luxor just in case, you know, I want to make sure that we get there on the Layla Kabira and also the Dora. But it is difficult to find out about. And the ones that have to do with the harvest is really difficult, because it's kind of like the, to say like the first new moon after the something, something after the something, something. It gets really difficult to figure that out. So, but the month of Shaban, you can usually, if you're there for a whole week, you can usually find some mulid somewhere. It might even be a little neighborhood one, but you'd be able to find them.
Nice. And, you know, in the event that you're lucky enough to find one, are most open to visitors, or is it something where you really should have an in?
I would say if it's large enough to have the children's, right. The thing is that, you know, the really small ones are more just the neighborhood. If it's large enough to have people traveling in, then they'll have the children's rides and kiosks and all that kind of stuff. So if you can visually see it, then it would be fine for you to go. It is people that are from the countryside that are not necessarily used to tourists, so you definitely should be modest in dress and action. But as long as you, you know, keep yourself covered and that kind of thing, then you would be welcome. However, if you're there watching a Sufi group, this is kind of funny. If you're there watching a Sufi group, and which I do, if I don't have a tour there, then I will be there for hours and hours and hours, a couple of days in a row. If I'm there with a tour group, then, you know, we can only be there for a little bit. But of course, I love just to feel the music, and so sometimes I've closed my eyes, and men have come by to tell me that there is, you know, if I want to, you know, trance out, then there is a woman's tent nearby, and I'm going, no, I'm not, and that's translated for them. And then one time a woman came up, and this was after I know I'd seen her for a couple years, and she came up and through my translator told me that if I do want to trance out, there is a woman's tent that's nearby. But she understands, because, of course, the music is better at this tent than the woman's tent. And this one's much more fun. And then she gave me the advice that if I wanted to trance out here, I had to do it like really fast, because once I had tranced, they weren't allowed to wake me up. So, and I'm just like, oh, okay. So all this was being, you know, translated by my translator, who was trying not to smile about the whole thing. So I appreciated her advice. It's fun because women find a way. And I thought that every once in a while, a woman will, you know, quietly give me some advice on how to accomplish whatever they think I'm trying to do. So I thought that was really nice of her.
So this is a little bit off topic, but that was one of my favorite themes from Journey Through Egypt 1, was how many ways that women find Are there any other examples you'd like to share just for fun while we're on the phone?
Oh my goodness. Let me think. I'm going through the file cabinet in my brain. It's just interesting that women will. Well, they're trying to figure. You know, I'm a foreigner. If I'm in the Upper Egypt, they have a feeling evidently that I'm coming from Cairo, so they know that I'm a foreigner to them. So they watch. So I'm a public person. I'm not just inside some, you know, my own home. So I'm out in public. So in that way, I'm a little bit of a man, right? But at the same time, for sure, I'm a woman. So they're kind of watching to see, you know, how do I go between these two worlds? And it was interesting to know that women have watched for years. And then every once in a while, they'll come up and quietly, you know, tell me how to accomplish whatever they think that I want to do. Like I used to go to this one mulet all the time. It's more of a neighborhood mulet, and it has a lot of horse dancing. So I went to it, and I got to sit next to the band that way. And it's all men. It's like hundreds of men. But I could sit next to the band because then they know that I'm guest of the band. So I'm not, you know, bothered by anybody, and nobody comes over to talk to me or anything like that. So anyway, so I'm over there with them. But I can see the women kind of hiding behind a wall and watching me. And so at one particular time, and, you know, we'd watch the horses and the horses and the horses. And I got the feeling like the men were not all, I don't know, it was weird. It's like they were waiting for something. And then the women started showing up behind the wall. So they didn't see the men couldn't see them, but I could see them. And then they'd smile and kind of wave at me, and I'd kind of a little bit wave at them. And then one of the mizmar players told me, you know, you can dance if you want to. And I'm going, no, no, that's okay. I'm not going to dance in front of all these men, you know. And so then he says, but you can dance if you want to. And I'm going, no, it's cool. I don't need to dance. Then after a while, I'd say, you can dance if you want to. And I'm going, wait, you want me to dance, right? And he goes, you know, he's looking at me like, what have I been telling you all this time, you know? So then I look at the women and kind of motion like a little dance movement and like shrug my shoulders like, should I? And they all nod yes. So I got up and danced a little bit. And as soon as I danced a little bit, then suddenly like 200 men put on hip scarves and started dancing. And it's like they were shy to start dancing in front of me. Although I know also Saidis are very cautious that they don't do something that would lose their respect or somebody would, really bad, make fun of them. But anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting that the women could feel like, okay, maybe she's going to dance, you know, and they're watching like, are you going to dance? And then I asked them, should I? And it's like, yeah. So I danced a little bit, and then suddenly all these men were dancing. And it's just like I had to break the ice and it was funny because I had heard so many times from people in Cairo, like, no, Saidi men wouldn't put on a hip scarf and dance. You know, of course they wouldn't do something like that. I'm going, no, but I've seen it. And they're going, no, you're a tourist. They'll do things just to make you happy. And I'm going, no, really, I've seen it, you know. But anyway, I can tell you for sure, Saidi men, if they feel private enough, we'll put on a hip scarf and dance. So that felt something very special. My friend took a little video of it on her phone and unfortunately lost it. So, but I don't know if that will ever happen again, but it survives in my memory strongly. But I know I wouldn't have danced if the women hadn't like encouraged me to. I had no idea. I wouldn't normally dance in front of, you know, it's not my, I didn't come as the entertainer, you know, it didn't feel quite right for me to, you know, go into somebody else's mulet and start dancing during a horse dance.
All right. And do you have any other favorite memories from some of the mulets that you've attended?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. There's so many. I just love being there, and the energy is happy and strong, and then to go by the different tents. And each tent is well, not each. Most of the tents are like three-sided tents. So it's open to one side. So anybody can stand there and watch, or it's definitely public. So I enjoy going there and watching that. I just enjoy the whole atmosphere. And then the Dora is just totally insane to have all these people out there in this parade, and just to see. People tell me in Cairo, no, Saidi men don't carry the Asaya anymore. And in the Dora, you see like maybe like about 2,000 men carrying Asaya at the same time. So it definitely happens. But, and there they have these decorated camels, but they decorate them like with scarves and hats. And it's just fun. It's just funny and fun. So, there's just so much to experience there. It's constantly surprising me all the time. And then go to other moulids, like there. I was there 1 week. Well, we finished the tour. I went back to Cairo to say goodbye to everybody, and then we flew back to Luxor to do more research. And there was only going to be like maybe about a week before Ramadan. So, it turns out that there was a couple new moulids, so people are making new moulids, and one was only a couple years old, but evidently the practice is not dying out. I still was trying to figure out who the saint was. Everybody was talking. I think they made it about some saint, because the real thing was a woman who had lost her son too early, as they said. He was probably about 4 or 5 years old. And she started channeling him. And so this whole moulid is based on this one woman. You go to her, and she channels him and gives you advice on things. And I kept trying to find out, what does she have to do with the saint? But they needed to have the moulid to be about a saint. So suddenly, an old saint. Now they have a new moulid about this old saint. But it's what I got was, it's really about this woman. It's things are constantly surprising me. And if I try to ration things out by my own mind, that doesn't always work that way. I have to keep my mind open.
This call is being recorded.
Sorry, I think I accidentally paused the recording for a second there. So did you finish your thought?
Yeah, it's just nothing specific comes to me. It's just the overwhelming feeling of learning new things. And for the research part, I'm doing a lot of interviews on Saidi musicians. And just lately, just this last year, I've also been doing interviews on like musicians who also play for Sufi singers. And then I also was able to interview a Sufi singer this last time, in the week that I was there before Ramadan. So that was just like 2 months ago. And I it's just, so nothing specific coming back, but it's just wonderful to keep learning more and more. And I think I understand something, and then there's just all this new information. So yeah,
All
so now I
right.
finished my thought.
Sure. And if listeners are interested in checking out some moulids and they happen to be able to find them, are there
Yes.
any in particular that you recommend looking up?
If they could find one in Cairo, it's probably the easiest one. So they probably would be able to find, this happens like in the old area, like where Khan Khalili and Hussein Mosque and Azhar Mosque, in this area. I think everybody can find Khan Khalili and Al Azhar Mosque, but you would like Prophet Muhammad's birthday or his mulid, and then there's also the Hussein. And it's fascinating because they are doing the zikr. They don't do the other things I've mentioned. They don't do the tatib. They don't do the mirmah, things like that. They do have the Layla Kabira, the big night, but they don't have the Dora. So each one has its own feeling. If you do go to one of these really big mulads in Cairo, I would suggest, for one thing, for sure, dress conservatively. Make sure your sleeves are at least 3/4 length and no bare legs. And you don't have to wear a headscarf, not in these last several years that they're back to secular government. But it is good to have your hair controlled in some way, like a bun or a braid or something like that. So just to show that you're conservative, it's also good to have at least one man in your group, whether it's just the two of you or you can have several women with one man. It's just, you know, just so people, because they're always trying to figure out what you want. And so you don't want to give them a wrong idea. But to be there, also there's usually places that you can go and just sit down and have coffee or tea or shisha or something and watch. And this is really fun too. You don't have to be walking around all the time. But at Al-Hussein, where they do the mulad is just right across from where you can get coffee and tea. And you can also be in a high building and watch the whole area down too. So that would be a good option. I would also say the Abu Hagag is wonderful because also Luxor people are rather used to tourists. So they won't really be trying to figure out who you are. They've pretty well figured that who tourists are. So that one's a fun one too. And it does include the other kind of things. So I would suggest those three.
Great. Yeah. Now, you know, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you've got some fairly recent research. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Who you've been talking to, how you gain access or anything that you've been learning?
Yes, this is so exciting. So exciting. Most of what I've been trying to break into Luxor for decades now. But in Luxor as well as the other areas, it's like, how can I say it? It's like you can't know until you know it. So once I was able to get access to musicians and to talk to them, then suddenly I had access to musicians. Also, a lot of the hotels that I was staying at, for some reason, wanted to keep tourists away from the local population, so they would put up dividing lines. Now that I live or stay on the West Bank, at this one particular place that they like music and dance, and they also have an impresario there that helps me a lot. So my research right now isn't just like going places and trying to talk. Now I go places and find out, you know, watch around what musician I want to interview. And I have my translator go and talk to him. And so that he understands what I want. And then we have an interview through that way. But now that I have access to the musician, it's been wonderful. I've really, really enjoyed it. It's kind of a complicated process because luckily my translator by now pretty well understands what I think is interesting. But so I'll ask the question. And then he translates it, just words. And then the impresario is there, and he'll translate it so that the musician will understand what I'm looking for. And then the musician talks. And then the impresario kind of translates it into simple English, but that also tells my translator. It's really kind of complicated, but it also kind of tells you different professions have different ways of saying things. And also the empresario now knows that I don't want just a real simplistic answer. It's like if I want to know about rhythm, he just doesn't give me the basic rhythm. He's, okay, so now the rhythm for this and the rhythm for that, the rhythm for that. I went down there thinking there was one Saidi rhythm. Mm-mm. Cairo thinks there might be one Saidi rhythm, but there were so many different rhythms. So when I start the archive, this is the first piece of, a video clip of the Pablo Beledi musician that I was talking to, and he said he'd give us an example of this, and I was just over the moon. The music is unbelievable. So what he did is he gave us a couple of different rhythms for Tatib. He gave us a rhythm for Gawazi dance. He gave us a rhythm for all these different kafafa, all sorts of different things. So because unfortunately, I mostly knew the Saeed through Cairo or through here. So, which basically means like the Rababa players of Met Al Kanawi's time. So it was fascinating to get in and really get into more depths of things. So anyway, I did a long interview with him, and he showed wonderful rhythms. And also then I've found him at several different Tatib contests and things like that, and videotape bits of that. So we'll have that in the archive too, just to watch. And then also I was able to interview a guy that has a Rababa band, and also Ms. Marr, and also the Nai, and two different Nai players. One of them actually makes the Nai as well. He would usually, if you're a Rababa or Ms. Marr player, you're Gawazi, so it's in the family. It's like you grow up playing that instrument. But if you end up playing the Nai or things that normally come out of Cairo, like accordion or organ or oud, something like that, then you're a family that normally does something else, but you personally are drawn to the music. So both of these Nai players were had other professions, but they were pulled to play Nai. And one of them had been a construction worker, and so he was pulled to play the Nai, and so he started making them. So he's the main maker of Nais in Luxor as well. So it's just been really fascinating to really get to know these people and hear their different stories and find out that different instruments have different, normal entries. So if it's Rababa or Ms. Marr, then they're usually Gawazi. And it's fun because I've gone to some of these places and they have their kids there. So the little like Rababa player, and he's like 5 or 6 years old, and he's playing right along with everybody else, because they're training him from that age. But other musicians are a personal choice, and they had to kind of fight for it because their families didn't want them to waste their time on something not very lucrative like music. So anyway, it's fascinating to hear their stories.
Now, you've been talking about the archive a little bit. Can you tell us more about that project?
That one is really exciting to me. When I started in Egypt, I was videotaping anyway because I was there to do my master's research. And the research was on the Zefet al-Arusa, so the bridal procession. So it literally means Zefet is procession with noise, because if it wasn't noisy, you wouldn't know what the subject was. And so Alarusa means the bride. So I was doing that research, which was really fun, and it's public and people are happy. And so I accidentally did the right thing. So that was really fun. Anyway, so I was videotaping that. And sometimes I would have to hire somebody that had a professional camera to do that as well. At some point, I finally got my own camera and started videotaping other things. And at that point in time, it was mostly, the Zephyr was no problem because it was meant to be public and photographed, so it wasn't a problem photographing that. But if I wanted to photograph normal people or other things, cameras still were rather invasive. You know, video cameras were large, and they didn't have like cell phones that they were taping each other all the time. Like my musicians, they didn't even carry photographs of their wife or their daughters or their sister because you just shouldn't have photographs of women. It was, you know, at that point in the early 90s. So a lot of my own research, my own videotaping, was asking people questions, men questions, and videotaping beautiful places like the Mediterranean at Mars Matrua and stuff like that. So now that I look back, is I had a whole lot of, it looks like vacation footage, and asking people some questions. As we went on, and that was also in taped cassettes. So I was kind of scared because, you know, over the years that those tapes, people told me, well, once that camera doesn't work anymore, now that's a different kind of camera with different kind of tapes, and those old tapes will just go bad, so you might as well throw them away. No way am I going to throw away any research, so I kept them. And so, you know, and I kept the camera until it broke, so I didn't think to, you know, put, you know, to change the data. We don't think of, I didn't think of those things, the media back then. But anyway, I kept them. And I kept doing it and doing it and doing it. So I had all these different kinds of cassettes, taped cassettes, of different sizes and different cameras and all this. When Tiffany came out, I told her, well, I have at least 50, you know, and then we started finding them. Oh, here's another box. Here's another box. So we had like 230 or something crazy like that. So anyway, so that's why we did the Kickstarter, because media had gotten to the point where I could bring all these different kinds of cassettes, and because I live near Hollywood, so that was nice too. So there was a professional place that I could bring all these things, and they had the different kind of technology to put all of this into digital form. So I still have the old, I still have the boxes of the old ones, but now I also have them in digital. So it was really exciting to go through these and find out what I had. And all along I wanted to share it with people, but it's like bringing your vacation home movies. Nobody wants to see them. So that was kind of frustrating, but I kept doing it. And then I started finding some people that might be interested in doing something like this. But of course, it's from a camera that no longer works anymore. So anyway, I have them now, and I've always wanted to share them with people who were interested. And I, judging from my own family, it's like they're so nice, but it's like asking your brother to explain some sports game or something. You know, he's fascinated by it, and you're trying your very best to look interested, but your eyes kind of glaze over. That's the way it was with all these videotapes and my friends. It's like they were being nice. They didn't really want to know about this. So anyway, when we started doing the Kickstarter, and we were hoping that we would make enough money so that we could get, you know, half of the videotapes into digital. And we were really crossing our fingers that we could make $7,000 by the end of the month so that we could get these things digitized. And I was trying to figure out, okay, which is the most important, and all this stuff. And Tiffany was saying that we could start an archive, that these would be available to people. And I really started getting excited. And then we made the 7,000 in 24 hours.
Nice.
So I know. I was so, I'm going to get emotional right now to think that there's all these people there that want to see them. And it's just time right now that we all start sharing our research and we put the bits of information together. And because a lot of times, you know, you start dancing and then after a while you start learning, oh, there is a thing called the Saeed and there is a thing called Saeedi dance. And some people still think you can, it's only, you know, with a stick. And, you know, it's like every class we have to start again. And it's just my feeling that if the research is shared and now we have a new starter point, you know? So we all already know that. We all already know what is Kafafa and the different kinds of Saeedi dance and the rhythms and, you know, about the diversity and the variety that's there. Okay, now we'll all start from that platform and go on from there. Can you imagine all that could be done? So anyway, so now that we've taken a couple years to do it, but we have it all digitized, and I've been doing the new interviews, which I'm really excited about, with really some strong condensed knowledge. And so I'm putting that into, you know, I don't know, I was calling it bite-sized pieces. So each clip is somewhere between 3 to 8 minutes or something like that. And then if anybody's talking, then I have that translated and I put in the subtitles. And then also along with that, then also a description of where this was taken and when and, you know, anything else that needs to be known to understand the clip. And also, you know, things that I'd learned from it. And anyway, so I get to write each one up. And right now we've got about 50 of them done, more than that. And so we're ready now to start the archive and make it available for people. And so I am really excited about that. It's just, and to think that we could also have a conversation. So it's not only just up there as if it was in a book, but even more so because it's visual, but also we're going to have a Facebook page, a group, I guess. I'm still new at all this. And that we can discuss what's up on the archive too. So anyway, I am so excited by all this. It's like finally it gets to be shared. And anytime I put any information out there, I always get all this interesting conversation back. And, you know, something that I was trying to figure out, somebody writes back and knows about it. And we all just, you know, we learn more and more and more every day. So it's an exciting project, and I'm really glad to be at this point. It should be, the archive page is up, but I think it's the grand opening, I guess it's going to be, what is it, August 1st, I think. So for the Kickstarter people to get it started is, I think, the 15th of July. And then the open to the public, I think it's the 1st of August, I think.
Awesome. Well, congrats.
Thank you. So,
and if people are interested who are not Kickstarter supporters, how can they sign up?
Okay. So Tiffany just sent me this yesterday. What they do is they look at this website and it has a starter page on it, and you click somewhere and you put your email in, and so then she will write you an email to tell you how to get everything started. So are you ready for that website?
Go for it. And for folks who are listening, I'll also put a direct link in the show notes, so if you have trouble spelling it out, no worries.
Okay, good. It's pretty simple, you know, straightforward. So it's archive, archive dot journey through Egypt, and completely spelled out but like one word, .com. That's it.
Great.
Pretty easy. So archive.journeythroughegypt.com. So it explains it on there, what you'll be seeing and all of the details all the details.
Great. So I just headed over there while we were talking, and I see that there's a button for keep me updated. So I'm guessing that's what we need. Excellent. All right. Well, I hope folks will check that out. And we are, you know, it's almost time to move on to question and answer. But before we do that, you know, if there's one thing that people take away from this call, what would you want that to be?
Oh, my goodness. I hadn't prepared for this one. Just basically, there's really an exciting world out there, which we all know that, but it's accessible. I'm filled with excitement for the whole thing. So I hope, because I hear some people say, oh, all of that is finished, and it isn't. There's plenty of modern things happening in Egypt, but there is also plenty of heritage and viewable heritage. And so anyway, yeah, I think that's what I would hope people would come away with.
Excellent. And besides the archive, are there any other ways that listeners can learn more from you that you'd like to talk about?
Wow. Basically, my whole mind is focused on, I did have some small articles up in journeysthroughegypt.com, so they can, you know, go there, and there's a few things there. Then we got the idea of the archives, so that all of the video would be my own, not just me finding things in YouTube and talking about them. But so that would be immediately possible. And mostly what I'm focused on right now is teaching Journey Through Egypt and putting the archive together. So
awesome. And is there somewhere where folks can find out when Journey Through Egypt is going to be offered?
Yeah, if you look at the, I think it's just called journeythroughegypt.com. I think it's just www.journeythroughegypt.com, but it has a place to click for, you know, upcoming events, and Journey Through Egypt is included in that. One and two are given around the world. This year, I'm going to go to pretty soon. I was just in Los Angeles, and I'm going to be in Los Angeles again with Aubrey, but then also different states, and then Jakarta, Indonesia, and then we go back to Egypt for another tour. And also this year I go to Japan and teach one and two in Japan, and also Washington, D.C. So quite a few different places.
Nice. All right. Well, I've taken only the first one, and even that I thought was spectacular. So I highly, highly recommend
Thank you so much for coming. We're so
oh, of
cool
course.
To be there.
Yeah. So, listeners, if you think this is geeky, you have no idea how much better it could get. So,
well,
right.
We can geek out pretty good. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All right. So, let's go ahead and jump right into questions and answers. So, if there are folks who are listening live, you can press ** to unmute yourself. If you're on Skype, you want to do that on the Skype keypad. If you're on a phone, you want to do it over the phone. If you're on the webcast, there should be a little microphone button when you hover over your tile. You should see that. Or if you prefer to type in a question, there's a question box on the right-hand side that looks sort of like a square cartoon bubble with three dots. Regardless, we would love to hear from you. So if you have any questions about mulids or about anything else you'd like to pick Sahar's brain about, don't be shy. Go ahead and ask. It looks like we've got a caller with a phone number from Hartford. Hi there.
Hello. Hi. My name is Sophia. It's been so informative and fun listening to you guys. This is great. I have a question about the Sufi music, since the Mu'ids seem to be pretty tied at the roots to Sufism. Is there a way, because I know Sufism has adherence all over the globe, really, and it kind of culturally shows up differently in different places, like Sufi music in India or in Turkey or in North Africa is all going to be very different. So is there a good way we can access Sufi music so we can listen to what it sounds like in terms of the Egyptian part of it? I don't know what Egyptian Sufi music would sound like. I guess I was hoping to see if we could find some sort of clips or...
Yeah, I'm trying to think how to... it will show up very quickly in the archive, my own recordings of it. I'm trying to think what's available right now.
I know it's hard because it's not like Sissy Music. They go into a studio and produce albums, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Really like that.
Exactly. And it was really funny there for a little while where, I won't get into the politics, but, you know, when the Shabby Maharajan first hit, they were taping all these different things and remixing them with a DJ and putting them out in cassettes, like within like 2 hours of the event. And suddenly there was all this remixed Sufi music that they recorded on the spot and then took it over to another studio like a block away and remixed it with the Shabby Maharajan, you know, style and got it out there. It is interesting stuff going on. I'm trying to think what would be the easiest way. Because mostly what I do is I find somebody sends me something and then I go down another rabbit hole in YouTube and one leads to the next and leads to the next. And the thing is that different Sufi groups, their music will be different. So like I said before, some of the Sufi group don't allow musical instruments. Other ones allow percussion, but no melody instrument. If you can wait, if you can wait until like about, how much, like about 4 weeks or something like that into the archives, then I'll put up the Sufi zikr that I recorded, and you can hear the music there, and it goes through quite a few different changes. Usually in Cairo, Sufi music is represented by a nai, an tura, and a frame drum. Whether the frame drum is a rik or a mezhar could be different. Do you have access to the makan, to videos from the makan? Because although they represent Tsar music, then there's always one Sufi piece in their repertoire. So if you can find McCann Center, I know they have a presence on YouTube, or you could also call it Mazahar, M-A-Z-A-R-H-E. I'm not sure how to spell it, but Mazahar, and that's the group. And so if you find an instrumental piece that has Nai, Tura, and frame drum, then that would be their Sufi piece.
What's the...
Oh, sorry, I didn't have a better answer for that.
You said Tura. What is that?
Tura are the really, really big sagat or finger cymbals.
Ah, okay.
Really big. It's like they won't even fit in most hands. But I was trying to figure out which things I should put on the archive first, and so that pretty well, you know, figured it out. I'm going to put Sufi pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. All right. Did that answer your question, Sophia?
Yeah. It sounds like kind of confirms what I was thinking, that it's just very decentralized because Sufism is not highly encouraged, so you really just have to go in and, you know, and experience it or try to explore and find it, because everything's going to be slightly different.
Unfortunately, very true. Very true. That's the thing, is it's once you get into a Sufi singer that's organized, you'll find like tape after tape after tape of him. Right now, if I, you know, I don't have a playlist for Sufism on YouTube, I don't think, but it's like the rabbit hole. You can find hundreds of things if you catch the right person to start with. And like you said, decentralized. The different singers, the different groups are going to sound different. So I didn't have a more specific answer for you.
No, it's okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the question, Sophia. If you have any others, feel free to ask.
My other question was, I know you mentioned that there are actually different Saidi rhythms. And it's like, that's something I would have assumed that there would be different ones, but I had no exposure to like know what those are. So I was wondering if you could give some basic examples of which rhythms could be different. Because in classes, they just tell us, you know, and it's the dum tek, dum dum tek, and they kind of just play that rhythm and.
Right, right. Well, that's a popular one, no doubt about that. I'm not good enough to really represent it right now, just myself. But when the first entry, when the archive opens, the first entry, and you'll be able to see it if you even put that you want to know in more information, the first thing that we're going to put up, because I found it really interesting, the first thing we're going to put up is samples of the tabla belody playing these different Saidi rhythms. So, which should probably be, I think, August 1st, I believe. That's a Wednesday. So when you just sign up there that, you know, you want to keep being, you know, informed about this, and you'll get an email, and the email will lead you to a video of at least four or five different rhythms. Because they have different ones for different parts of the tatib, and they have different ones for kafafa and gawazi and all this things. But the one that you're hearing that's so popular, this is definitely one of the basic performance rhythms. That's good.
All right. Thanks, Sophia. I'm going to go ahead and mute you.
Thank you.
And it looks like we've also got a question from Sharzad.
Okay, good.
Hi there.
Hi.
I see that she's unmuted, but I'm not hearing from her just yet. Sharzad, if you're trying to talk, it may be that your own phone is on mute rather than just the conference line. Okay, nothing yet. So I'm going to go ahead and mute her again. Sharzad, if you do want to try that again, feel free to press star star one more time. In the meantime, if anybody else has a question or, looks like we've got an unmute. Hi there.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi there, it's Kay Campbell. Hi, Sahra. Hi, Nadira. How are you?
Oh, my goodness.
Okay,
how are you doing?
Sorry, I have you mislabeled on the conference line.
Okay, well, I just have been really loving this. Thank you so much for sharing what you're doing with the Mulid. It's just such a fascinating topic, and I love hearing what you're up to, and I wish you all the best with the archive.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Your perspective is just so great, how, you know, the thing you said earlier about how, you know, as you said, you go down a rabbit hole or you start down a project, then you find out, oh my God, there's so much more to learn. And I'm feeling myself in the same
You know about this one, I know.
Yes, I do. And I just, it's so exciting. And I loved hearing how, you know, your view on how the women helped you and they watched you over a period of years and then, you know, helped you figure out what you wanted to get. That is just amazing. But I wanted to tell you that someone shared with us at the Arabic Music Retreat a couple of years ago this amazing video of a puppetry version of an operetta called Alayla al-Kabira, which is composed by Saeed Makawi. And it's the story of the Mulid in puppetry with live music. And I'm going to post the whole video. The whole video is available on YouTube, and I'm just going to plop it into the Facebook group of this podcast.
Excellent. I'll include that in the show notes, too.
Yes. Okay, great. Anyway, that's all. I just want to say amazing, amazing, and all the best with your next venture. So I will sign off now.
Thank you so much for calling. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice, and best of luck.
And you too. You too on all your endeavors.
All right. Thanks, Kay. And for those of you who do not know Kay, she is also a multiple-time Clubhouse guest. So she's talked to us a lot about Khaliji music and culture.
Good, good.
Awesome. All right. So we are awfully close to the 90-minute mark. Let's say we have time for one more question or comment. So if anybody else wants to weigh in, we would love to hear from you. One more time, that's ** to unmute yourself. I love puppet shows. There's so many great things that get, you know, it's such a great medium. You know, we associate it with, you know, just Sesame Street and little kids stuff.
Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
Okay, because I know they have, like, especially now, they have, like, the 3D puppets, but also they have the shadow puppets, too, and I've been seeing that start having a return, too, in the more Bellady neighborhoods.
Cool.
So that would be interesting to see.
Yeah, once Kay posts that, I'll include that in the show notes, too, so folks can listen.
Yeah, good.
Awesome.
Good.
Well, I think that looks like it's it for questions. So let's go ahead and wrap it up. Thank you so much, Sahra.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
This has been a ton of fun. And just to let everybody else know what's going on in the Belly Dance Geek world, the 2018 offering of Rock the Routine is starting on July 8th. Rock the Routine is our 7-week online course where we cover the 6-part American Cabaret routine from intro to finale. So we talk about how it's structured, what the audience expects, both in terms of aesthetics and music, and also some improvisation strategies to help you deliver it in the moment. And this is actually the last year that I'm going to be offering this as a live course that I'm leading myself. The home study will be available indefinitely, but if you want to do it directly with me, this is your last opportunity. So go ahead and sign up at bellydancegeek.com/rock-the-routine. Or if that's too tricky, you can also find it at bellydancegeek.com/store. And thank you, everybody, for coming. This is the end of our call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. As Kay mentioned, we have a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members. That is free, but you do have to sign up because we do vet everybody to make sure that they're actually a part of the dance community. So I'll be sending out an email shortly, which will include the recording from this call, an invitation to the Facebook group, a link to the show notes with some of the resources that were mentioned, and also a link to our survey where you can suggest topics, speakers, or other improvements. Our next call is coming up pretty soon. We actually pushed this one a little bit farther back to work around some schedule issues. So let me just confirm the date. That is going to be on Thursday, July 19th, and my previous guest Farha is going to be returning. So go ahead and mark your calendars. And then the last thing that I want to say is that, as always, this is the come on in kind of Clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody who would like to geek out with us, you can invite them to do so at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.